Hello and welcome back to Sobre Mesa with me, your host, Alan Maguire. Today is Monday, the 31st of August, 2020. And after a two-week break, there's plenty of news to catch up on. Now, August, obviously, in Spain is a very hot time and normally the country shuts down for several weeks. And this week it has been waking up. However, the difference this year is obviously like for everywhere, the coronavirus, which has seeped its way into every aspect of day-to-day life. Despite that, the Spaniards and mainly the Spanish government have still taken their holidays. Now, the tourism sector in Spain has suffered tremendously, but, you know, around my neighbourhood, in a commuter town just outside Madrid, there are plenty of shops shut saying, you know, we're shut for 2 weeks, we need some time off. But they're not the only people... that have shut down for August. The politicians have also been on holiday. Pedro Sanchez went on holiday to the beach. He was criticised by the opposition leader, Pablo Casado from the PP, being on holiday on the beach in a time of national crisis. The ironic thing is Pablo Casado was on the beach at the time of actually criticising the Prime Minister. And the Vice President and his partner, René Montero, the equality minister, had to cancel their holidays because of threats to their children from the far right. They were planning to go on holiday in Asturias and there was things spray painted on the road, and apparently there was information handed to them that there had been threats on their children's life. So normally politics would go very quiet in August, and there's been plenty going on because of the coronavirus, but also because of the challenges that the country faces. And, you know, Spain has been hit economically, probably the worst in Europe, but also there's been a rise in coronavirus cases. The deaths haven't started to rise yet, but it is suspected that in the next few weeks, the number the mortality rate will rise in the country. Why has there been a second spike in Spain earlier than the most other countries in Europe? Because, you know, it's rising in Europe, but in Spain it's been going on over the past sort of month and a half. Now, people say that the reason that the second spike has come up is because of, you know, we exited the lockdown too quickly. Regions have been slow to implement suggestions from the central government. You know, Spain is a very hot country, very sociable country, and the youth have been locked up for months in their houses. So it is the young and the healthy going out socializing, and it is them that are picking up the illness, and they are spreading it around. So the transmission rate is going up, but the death rate isn't. But, you know, as these young people spread the illness around, the healthy people, they will eventually spread it to the more vulnerable. So this isn't just elderly people, but this is people with their immune systems are compromised, maybe due to medication or due to other illnesses that they may have. The illness is also spreading around poorer neighborhoods because, you know, they live close together. They have less space. They have to go to work. Normally their work isn't, they aren't able to do it from home. They have to go and physically do it. So the virus is spreading. And we will probably see mortality rates go up within the next few weeks. But the other big news, not just in Spain, but, you know, all over Europe at the moment and all over the world, is how children are going to return to school in the academic year in September, which is tomorrow. And now the government will criticise for not having a plan. Apparently they've had a plan. They've been working on this, you know, since the coronavirus started, really. But like health, the education is the responsibility of the Comunidad, the regional autonomy, regional autonomous Comunidad. It's up to them to implement the plan. But, you know, it's not so much that there is no plan in place or the lack of plan, but it's the lack of communication about these plans that seems to be frustrating parents, teachers, and, you know, not just that, but it's going to have a knock-on effect. Regional governments, some have been communicating their plans. Others, like the Madrid regional government, one of the biggest people to make a criticism of the central government during the state of alarm, asking for their regional powers back, saying that we can manage the crisis better than you are, actually asked for the central government to step in. So Isabel Ayuso, the president of the Madrid region, where I live, was asking for central government to step back in and, you know, sort of take over. Pedro Sanchez's response to all of this criticism was basically, we'll give you the funds, the communities are in charge of education, but we will also give you personnel from the army to carry out track and trace, which, you know, is one of the biggest reasons that the second spike has come up, because Spain, you know, didn't invest and hasn't invested in track and tracing. I mean, some regions have invested, others haven't. So, you know, that is the reason why, another reason, one of the many reasons, why we have had a second spike earlier than most of the rest of Europe. You know, France's numbers are on the rise and so are Germany's, but Spain is a clear example of what happens if you come out of lockdown too quick and don't have a backup plan. Also, lack of communication to the public has been an issue. You know, data hasn't been formulated and communicated clearly. Measures such as wearing masks, you know, these messages have been mixed. What you can and cannot do, because you're getting messages from central and regional government. Now, a lot of this from health and education, you know, they are the responsibility of the regional governments. But what Spain does lack, and this is, you know, this is something that was there before coronavirus and it's just been exacerbated by the pandemic, is, you know, strong national standards. It doesn't have to mean everything is centralized, you know, it can mean standards are set and, you know, communities have to meet these standards so that all citizens across the country, no matter what region they're from or what language they speak, whether they speak Catalan, Castellano, Gallego, Valenciano, you know, they all have the same standards. So this is a huge criticism, and I think it's going to be something that blows up in the future. Now, talking of money and centralization, the central government at the moment need to pass a budget. Now, this would have been the coalition government's biggest test. However, coronavirus came along, like everything in life, and it's just changed everything. So the budget that they were hoping to pass is being sort of negotiated. They're trying to line people up. Last week, Pedro Sanchez met with business leaders, trying to put some pressure on the Partido Popular and the Ciudadanos parties. He has been working close with Ciudadanos, with their new leader, who's just come back from maternity leave, Inés Arrimadas. Now, Ciudadanos are seen as Podemos's sort of arch rival. During the December election of 2019, I was in a Podemos-friendly bar in the centre of Madrid, and when Ciudadanos lost all of their seats, more or less, they completely bombed that election because of their move to the right. They, you know, the whole room roared. And, you know, that rivalry is coming up now, with Podemos last week saying that basically we will veto. If you do a deal with Ciudadanos, we're not going to vote for the budget. So that would mean that the budget couldn't pass. Now, this was blown out of proportion a bit over the weekend by the newspapers. But basically what they want is they want the PSOE to sit down with them as coalition partners and agree a budget that they can take to Ciudadanos, and they will have red lines, you know, as a coalition government rather than as the PSOE going to negotiate with Ciudadanos. Now, the reason they're negotiating with Ciudadanos is because the left-wing Republicans from Catalonia, who the ERC, who were the ones that abstained during the investiture, so they made the coalition possible because they abstained and they didn't vote against it. They might not be able to vote for the budget because it might coincide with regional elections in Catalonia, which, you know, were announced back in March. because of Torda getting into trouble over various things, but mainly because he kept pro-partisan or pro-independence ribbons on a state institution. Now, during times of election, whether that's regional or general, the state apparatus is meant to be away from any party politics. And that is the same very reason that the ERC won't be able to support the government budget, because it could be seen as this is what we will do if you vote for us. So it will be seen as supporting or buying votes effectively. So the government can't rely on the ERC votes for the budget because of election laws possibly. So they're obviously trying to convince the Ciudadanos and even the PP to help vote to pass the budget. Now, the other complication with this is that Ciudadanos are very wary of doing any deal that involves the ERC because Ciudadanos are very pro-Spain. They come from Catalonia, but they are very pro-Spain and they don't like independentists. It's also worth remembering that whilst Pedro Sanchez might be flirting with Ciudadanos, they only have a few seats, so it's not going to solve all his problems. And there's also the added fact that Bildu from the Basque Country probably won't do a deal if it involves the Ciudadanos. So there's going to be a lot of political maths in the coming months in Spanish politics. There's many other things going on in Spanish politics at the moment as well. There's the no confidence motion that's been put forward by Vox. Santiago Abascal is going to be the candidate. So they were going to try and find a unity candidate, but they decided to go for their leader instead. Now, whilst this is probably going to fall, and I don't think the government are worried about it, it acts more as a challenge towards the PP and Pablo Casado's kind of lukewarm leadership. He's even had issues within his own party. A couple of weeks ago, he sacked the spokesperson, Cayetana de Álvarez de Toledo, and she's decided to stay to see how much autonomy a deputy within the Partido Popular can actually have. Could even be a slow-burning leadership bid, in my opinion. Now, Spanish politics has and will always be in crisis, and there will always be stories to report on. And I want to change the format of this podcast to fit in with other aspects that I think are also important in Spanish society, whether that be culture or something more orientated towards society itself. So the format for this podcast is going to include a 10 to 15 minute news update at the start of every episode on the recent ongoings within Moncloa or there's any other national stories of interest. I will be bringing them to English speaking audiences with some analysis. But I'm also going to start bringing in other people because my monotonous voice has the ability to send people to sleep. So, and I also want to practice my interview skills. So I'm going to start introducing different people from around the world. Obviously, most of these people will be from Spain, but due to the wonders of Zoom, I'm able to interview people, experts from all over the world. Not just experts, but academics, people who are generally interested in politics, people who might be affected by issues, and people who generally have an informed opinion about different aspects of Spanish society and culture. Now, the topic that I have chosen to concentrate on over the next coming episode is identity. So this is not only talking about the Spanish national identity, but also regional identities and identities within the country itself. I had the opportunity and the pleasure of interviewing Professor Sandy Olguin, who currently lives in the United States. but is originally from Spain. In this part of the interview, we talk about the construction and history around the Spanish national identity. Remember that this podcast is available on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. Please subscribe and share it with your friends and family. Today, I have with me Professor Sandy Olguín, who is a cultural intellectual historian who specializes in modern Spain. She's also the author of Flamenco Nation, The Construction of Spanish National Identity. Hello, Sandy. Welcome to Sobremesa.
Hi, thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you. So today, over this series, we're going to be talking about the Spanish national identity, which for anyone that's been living in Spain for the last sort of 2 or 3 years, really, is sort of come to the light again. It's bubbled up, people wearing Spanish wristbands and I remember walking down through Salamanca, the district Salamanca, which was all like beautiful and white buildings, and then a couple of weeks after the Catalan referendum, it was just all yellow and red flags. And you know, it's not always associated with the far right or anything. I mean, it does have heavy connotations, but I thought it was interesting to do a series of interviews with someone that knows about the Spanish identity. So thank you, Sandy, for coming on. So Sandy, it's often said that Franco constructed the modern day stereotype and identity of Spain, and it was sort of in the image of Andalusia, so very much bullfighting, flamenco, but also the sort of macho stereotype, Catholic. How true is this really?
I don't think it's true, at least in the way you're phrasing it.
Uh-huh.
What I would say is that he reinforced that stereotype, but those right. stereotypes of Spain have been going on since at least the late 18th century, and definitely solidified in the early 19th century. Uh-huh. This idea that Spain was Andalusia, that it was bullfighting, beggars, bandits, etc.
Yeah.
And flamenco dancers later on. But yes, that was really all begun in the 19th century. At least all the travelogues I read, people were commenting, they'd always go and take visits to Andalusia when they were doing their tours of Spain. They'd, you know, start in Barcelona, head to Madrid, but get as quickly to Andalusia as possible. Uh-huh. And then they would write about those areas because it seemed to be the most exotic compared to other parts of Europe.
Uh-huh. And more exotic, I suppose, compared to the north of Spain as well.
Yes, right, because you have Granada and Sevilla, which seems to, the places look like they're this combination of Catholic and Muslim cultures. And so people get, especially romantic writers, get quite taken with Granada and the Alhambra and the stories of the Reconquest and all of those sorts of things.
Uh-huh.
So Franco was, it's true that he then took the ball and ran with it when it came to using Andalusia as a stereotype. But it was one that was already there for many, many years. And in fact, throughout much of the 19th and early 20th century, you had lots of intellectuals, especially, who just wanted to reject the stereotype of Spain being Andalusia. And uh-huh. they fought against it and fought against it. But finally, when during the Franco dictatorship, he and others around him knew that foreigners especially were quite smitten by Andalusia, and so used that as his focal point. And in fact, there's a fantastic movie called Bienvenido, Mr. Marshall, which plays on that stereotype.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing that, actually. So prior to the Civil War, there was intellectuals trying to like bat off the stereotype.
Yeah.
Was that during the Second Republic or?
Yeah, there were some definitely who wanted to do that, especially in the Second Republic, when you had intellectuals and artists get together with the various Republican governments to try to bring Spanish culture to the pueblos in the mountains and, you know, in rural areas. And one of the things that they tried to emphasize is that all parts of Spain had incredible folk culture that people needed to be proud of. So it wasn't just Andalusia. When they went there, they, of course, you know, talked about Andalusian folk culture.
Uh-huh.
But they were in, you know, Soria or something like that, they would talk about other forms of popular culture.
Wow. So foreigners visiting really were the ones that helped spread the stereotype more so than Franco, the travelogues of the 19th century.
By the time you get to Franco, it's, you've got the, you know, the nascent tourist, well, it's not even nascent anymore, but you have a tourist industry which is trying to bring foreigners across. And so they're playing to the foreigners' stereotypes. And so I call it a feedback loop that you had people who had resisted this stereotype, but once you want to get foreigners in, you do this sort of thing all the time. It's, you know, like any tourist industry, right? Uh-huh. What do you talk about when you talk about London? It's Big Ben and Westminster Abbey and
all these
things and for anybody who lives there, you can ignore that most of the time. But tourists want to see those things.
No, I completely see the label of the feedback loop, definitely. I mean, in my interaction, like, I got married in Cordoba. So, you know, probably the most outside the mosque as well. So, and we did it for the very reason that my family were coming from the UK. They would want to see something very Spanish. But, you know, I guessed at the wedding and they basically told me, reminded me that, you know, not all Spaniards dance flamenco and drink sangria, Alan, right. Or especially don't drink Cruz Campo, was what one pointed out. But do you think this sort of stereotype that's been spread around the world, I mean, by the people that wrote the travel logs and later by Franco, and I suppose by like later governments as well, promoting tourism, mm-hmm. but these stereotypes, do you think they have much influence on Spaniards themselves, like on their own perception of what it means to be Spanish?
It depends on what region of Spain you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
You know, you talk to people who are Gallegos or Catalans, they say these things don't have any influence on them whatsoever, or sometimes they'll act against them, like the way Barcelona banned bullfighting, right?
Mm.
They don't want to be associated with that kind of cultural stereotype.
Uh-huh.
And in Andalusia, it would be less so, but they also know, and I would say they embrace these kinds of stereotypes more because it is part of their regional culture much more distinctly than it is in other parts of the country.
Mm. What other elements, aside from the sort of Andalusian sort of stereotypes and the travelogues and tourism and things, what other elements do you think have a big influence on Spanish identity, the more modern Spanish identity?
Yeah, well, you talk about as if there's one identity, right?
Yeah, well, that's true, yeah, but yeah.
Right, so there's the national identity that,
yeah,
you have central governments that are pushing in one way or another, and part of me would say that identity is very tied to the EU, right?
Okay.
And this notion that Spain is a modern country, it is part of this European unit, it isn't that great. While I'm saying we here, while we have our traditions still that are, you know, considered very Spanish, we also see ourselves as looking to be part of this broader European culture.
Uh-huh.
And that's been another kind of conflict that's occurred since, you know, at least the Enlightenment period. Is Spain a part of Europe, or is it something deeply exotic and different? And depending on where you stand in the political spectrum, you're going to have a different answer for that kind of identity.
Uh-huh.
I think in the modern era, though, that Spain sees itself as part of the EU. And yet you have those splits, right, within like Catalonia, which sees itself as part of the EU, but not part of Spain.
Mm. Mm.
But I bet that you take a lot of the, not sort of the highly politicized ones, but you take your probably average Catalan, whatever that is, and you stick them in Great Britain, or better yet, in like Japan or the United States, and they meet somebody from Andalusia or Madrid, and they're probably going to see themselves more as belonging to Spain than as belonging to Catalonia, because one of the things that I argue, and I kind of firmly believe this, is that identity is oppositional.
Mm.
And depending on where you are, you're going to change whatever your identity is.
Mm-hmm.
So I see myself, even though I live in Oklahoma, I see myself fundamentally as a Californian. Mm-hmm. But when I go to another country and I meet an American from a different region, it's like, oh yes, we're Americans. Or you just feel more American. You probably feel more British in certain ways culturally when you are in Spain than when you're in Great Britain.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Hmm.
So I think those kinds of, those identities switch depending on whose company you keep.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's definitely true. Yes.
And then, of course, you have the, you asked me earlier, what are the other forces playing on national identity? The educational system.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the things under the Franco regime, that the educational system was very Catholic. It was very nationalist, very conservative, all of these sorts of things. And then once you got this transition to democracy and the autonomous regions that assert more sovereignty within themselves, their educational systems are going to be much more focused on these regional identities.
Uh-huh. And I mean, education is quite political here, isn't it? It's quite a big political football.
Everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose I mean more between the regions, that there's often rumors that Catalonia teach a different history to the rest of Spain, and and as you say, they're going to reinforce regional stereotypes or teach regional histories and things.
Right, right. I bet they teach, various kinds of wars in very different ways in Galicia than they do in Catalonia, than they do in Andalusia.
Uh-huh. And do you think it's changed the national sort of identity with the change to with the transition to democracy and the sort of the separation of education between the regions?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's changed, but it's changed in different ways, depending, again, on what you're talking about, right? ETA was very big in the 70s and 80s and even some in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of Basque nationalism, that has tempered considerably. Catalan nationalism was much more, it was there, but it was a little more soft-spoken. And then when the economy started collapsing in Spain, it became much more assertive.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't lived there in quite a long while, so I don't know how things are going to end up, but I'd just say that these kinds of things are constantly in flux.
Mm.
If your central government is failing you, then you're probably going to be much more willing to be a regional nationalist.
Mm. Yeah, no, I can definitely see what you mean there. I think we're definitely in one of those fluxes at the moment as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just my last question regarding like the national identity, you say you haven't lived here for a while, but do you think it's changed since you've been outside, like your view of the Spanish national identity? Is it changed since leaving Spain for you?
I don't know. I mean, obviously it seems to me that Catalan nationalism has become stronger since I've left.
Uh-huh.
I don't know the day-to-day things that are operating, but certainly, the quest for independence for some people is stronger than I've seen it.
Mm.
But I'm kind of ignorant. I just, for me, I'm anti-nationalist of any sort. I find that if you become too nationalist, you get problems.
Uh-huh.
See Vox, for example,
or
white nationalism that is upped its ugly, reared its ugly head in my country. I think it can get pretty dangerous. There's a fine line between patriotism and ultranationalism and xenophobia and racism.
Right. Yeah. No. Definitely. And in your sort of research into identity, have you noticed any sort, I think you mentioned something earlier about the economy, when your central government or the economy is in flux or failing you, does this have a stronger effect on the national identity, and how's that sort of played out in your view?
Well, I think it what it tends to do is it strengthens regional national identities. weakens the centralized one. But then if the regional national identity tries to do something like secede, then you're going to get stronger national identities. Uh-huh. For example, that the Spanish flags that you saw in Salamanca.
Yeah.
Although that doesn't surprise me, given that it's the Salamanca neighborhood too, which tends to be more conservative to begin with.
Yeah.
I would want to see, you know, how many flags did you count in Carabanchal or something?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's definitely true. Yeah, not as many definitely as Salamanca. one thing that I've seen recently, it's quite strange, is the masks for coronavirus. People wearing the Spanish flag on their mask. And it's that sort of, like you said, that fine line between being a patriot and nationalism.
Right.
And, you know, Pedro Sanchez has been seen wearing a mask with the Spanish flag on as well. So, you know, and he's in the sort of center-left party, isn't he? So there is like a rise. I'm not sure that's due to a time of national crisis or yeah. Is it just.
Well, I mean, I think you also mentioned earlier Vox. That's kind of, and I wasn't thinking when you asked me the question. I mean, that's a major change from the last time I was there, the rise of Vox. And that's a big deal. And I see that as, you know, I mean, yes, they're getting funded by Stephen Bannon in our country and people and evangelical Christians in the United States. So they're getting funding from that. But I think because you had, you know, the whole European issue with migration and just lots of people migrating at a time when the economy was bad, that this was seen as the Vox was seen as this kind of way of pointing the fingers at immigrants and people who are so-called not Spanish coming in and taking over, quote, our jobs. That also asserts that particular kind of identity when you have that kind of social change that's very quick.
Yeah.
That as well.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of youth going towards Vox. Apparently it's like a trendy thing to vote Vox. You know, a lot of young people wearing the sort of Spanish band. Like, again, it's that sort of fine line between, you know, wearing a Spanish football shirt and voting for a very nationalistic far-right party. And I suppose for the young, it's a new identity. The Spanish identity isn't something to be scared of and probably something to sort of associate to, really. I'm not sure. But yes, it's strange times, I think, for the Spanish identity at the minute.
Yeah, very much so. But I think this is a worldwide phenomenon, this rise of right-wing parties.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's accidental.
No, definitely. Have to definitely see these things in the wider picture.
I write a lot about national identity and national stereotypes in my book, Flamenco Nation, if people are interested in reading it. It was published in 2019 with the University of Wisconsin Press.
Perfect. Thank you. If you've made it to the end of this podcast, I'd like to thank you very much for listening. And I'd also like to thank Sandy for letting me interview her. As I said earlier, you can get this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Please share it with your friends and family, so that we can get a few more listeners. That's it from me. See you next week with another interview and another update on Spanish news.